Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Again, Kelly Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine and antiwar.com. Welcome back. How are you doing, Kelly?
I'm doing great.
Great. Very happy to have you on the show tonight. Appreciate you joining me, especially on short notice and all.
Yeah.
And a couple of very important articles you've written here that I want to try to turn people's attention toward. Afghanistan's deadly indecision in the American Conservative Magazine, and then Blowback in Iraq, the Petraeus legacy comes home. At UNS.com, the UNS review. First of all, to Afghanistan, not many people have been paying much attention. Not much media has been directed toward the situation there. But they're still fighting, or they have been, fighting over the election results there. And then John Kerry went. I saw on Twitter people were saying, did John Kerry actually just accomplish a thing? What happened? He went over there and struck some kind of deal. So could you please give us a background, fill us in?
Absolutely. Well, we were down to two candidates. There was a recent runoff election. The first election was in April. There was, I don't know right offhand, but there was at least, 10 candidates in that election. It came down to Abdullah, who's this is the second time that he's run. He lost to Karzai. Last go around, he was in a runoff with Karzai and decided to leave the race because he felt that Karzai had rigged it to the point where he had not a shot of winning. And he was probably right in that regard. There was a tremendous amount of fraud in the 2009 election that had really been hanging over this election. So Abdullah, who is, he's part Tajik. Part Pashtun, he had actually fought the Taliban with, he had been a member of the Northern Alliance. He was sort of like in the front office. I don't believe they did any physical fighting, but he was a top official in the Northern Alliance, which, it played no small role in helping the U.S., oust the Taliban from Kabul in 2001. Mm-hmm. He has served as the foreign minister for Karzai and has been an official in the Karzai government, but has really been trying for some time now to be the next president. So this is his second go-around. Turns out
he was the CIA pick back in 2009, wasn't he?
Abdullah?
Yeah.
I think that he was a favorite. He was a favored candidate because, at that point, the administration had been so fed up with Karzai.
Right.
That I think it was more like, anything but Karzai.
Yeah, it was funny because they even tried to, one of the ways that they tried to get Karzai in trouble was the CIA put it on the front page of the New York Times that Karzai's brother is a CIA agent and a heroin dealer.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's compromised.
Well, we could talk more about Abdullah, but just to give the sort of abridged version.
Yeah, sorry.
Not at all. I mean, there's more to Abdullah, but he has been a familiar face in Afghan politics for some time. He is currently he won the election, but you have to get at least 50% of the vote. And in the initial election, for there not to be a runoff, he got like 46%. And with Ashraf Ghani coming in second. Now, Ashraf Ghani is a Pashtun. He's Western educated, had worked in the West. He had been a professor in the United States at Georgetown. He had worked for the World Bank. He'd worked for, had been an advisor with the UN. He's very popular. He's very popular against more of the reformer Afghans. But this, he did do well in the 2009 election, but did very well. He came in second during this election. So the runoff was between Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah. What happened was, but the results were, were finally released earlier this week, it looked like, these are preliminary results. Ashraf Ghani had won this runoff by about 1 million votes. And all the way up until this point, Abdullah had been crying fraud, saying that there had been ballot stuffing and other rigging and fraud going on, particularly in the Pashtun areas, and that he was not going to concede the race until they could separate the clean votes from the fraudulent ones. So, before the results were even released on Monday, he had already said, that there was a widespread fraud, and he would not concede. So when the results, were released, he and his supporters were saying, "We will not concede. We consider ourselves the winner." So there was a big concern that he would declare a sort of parallel government. That didn't happen, though. His supporters were calling for one. Then John Kerry swoops in and helps broker a deal so that every single vote of the 8 million votes, which was an incredibly large turnout, which had raised a few eyebrows in itself. There was much bigger turnout than the original April election, and in areas that had barely any votes, in districts, an extraordinary turnaround from the first election. Mm-hmm. So he brokered a deal that every one of those votes will be recounted. And both men agreed. They stood on a stage with Kerry, took some pictures. They also agreed to a so-called unity government so that whoever wins will incorporate the other side within, his government. Though, as some analysts have pointed out, there has been no definition of what a unity government is. And, Abdullah's people are already going on record saying, well, this means that it's basically a co-government, 50-50. And Ashraf Ghani's people are saying, we don't really see it that way, but we, they're basically saying, we're not going to just hand out positions because we have to. We're not going to just, like Karzai did, we owe this guy a favor, you can take finance minister, or we owe this guy, you run the bank. Ghani is basically trying to actually talk and walk the walk, and he's saying this isn't going to be a patronage government, so we'll have to talk about that. So I think there's going to be some more brokering to be done in terms of what a unity government, quote unquote, will mean. But so far, at least nobody's declaring civil war on the other side, which this could actually dissolve into if cooler heads hadn't prevailed. And I guess for once that John Kerry actually did accomplish something, though some of that might have been already in the works. It just needed, sort of like a guiding hand, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and it kind of sounds like he may have just kicked the can down the road if they're going to fight about what it means to have this coalition. I guess I had thought maybe I'd read somewhere that one was whoever wins gets to be the president, and then the runner-up gets to be the prime minister, and then they'll have to fight over which office has which powers.
Yeah, I think that's part of this whole confusion over what unity government really means. And I think Abdullah's people were pretty speedy in getting in front of reporters and basically defining it themselves. And that's probably what you heard. There's no prime minister in the Constitution right now, I don't believe.
Oh.
That would be part of going in and re-debating and reworking the Constitution, which Ashraf Ghani has said, the one statement that he has made since this deal was that, yes, we should have a loyal jirga and go back into the Constitution because it's an imperfect Constitution. So, that is on the table. But they'd have to change the Constitution from that. But I think that maybe Abdullah's people are going straight to social media and talking about this unity government as though it is more of a partnership and not, a winner in opposition. The way that it would, is most likely envisioned by the other side. So I don't see, when I wrote my story, there was a real tension in the air about whether or not Abdullah's people were just going to say, well, we're winners, so we're just going to create our own government. And that could have really touched off a crisis there. Right. This actually, you know, is in a, going in a more positive direction. And, you know, I between the two guys, I mean, I think they both have their flaws. And Abdullah, like I said, he's been around for a long time, and there's a lot of people who don't like him, who believe, you know, he's part of this old guard that really feathered their nest with all of the U.S. aid and money that has been pouring into that country, and they've been sitting pretty and, you know, basically building their personal wealth, and they see it all going away with Karzai leaving and a possible Ghani presidential election. And so they have a lot to lose, you know, and that's, you know, that's not good. That's part of the corruption that, that has basically been serving as a stone around the neck of Afghanistan all these years, that the corruption, they can't seem to get out of this hole. That's a bad thing. But I you know, looking at Iraq, I don't think that they're politically are as in a bad as position as Iraq is right now, because I don't think that we're actually, you know, we're not seeing a handover to an authoritarian figure the way that, you know, the power had been, you know, sort of centered on Maliki when we left. And he was already, you know, exercising all of these authoritarian impulses over the Sunnis. And now you see, you know, that all coming back to roost now. I'm not saying that, you know, Afghanistan's in much better shape, because they got all their own problems. And, you know, we're not even brought up the Taliban yet. But I think between these two guys, I can't see them being any worse than Karzai, and if not better, you know. So, yeah. You know, I just don't see any reason to really get or be fearful of what's going to happen there. And, you know, maybe we will get out of Afghanistan at some point, you know, like we had planned, without leaving, you know, a huge humanitarian mess there. I mean, who knows? I don't have the crystal ball, but what's happening in Iraq, I think, could have been predicted and was predicted many years ago before we even left. And that's just what's happening there. It's just very sad. Mm-hmm.
Well, so what about the Taliban? Because they're just sitting around waiting until it's their time, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely different schools of thought. You know, I've talked to different folks, and they say, you know, some people are convinced that the Taliban could really mount a real attempt to take over the government again, and it, you know, and take back Kabul, the pre, you know, 2001. And other people think that Taliban might be just satisfied of keeping whatever territory they have already, and then finding a way to worm their way into the government, you know, and have political power as well. So I'm not an expert on.
And there's been some of that, right? I remember Ann Jones telling me that, oh, Taliban coming to town. Let me tell you, Taliban's here right now. They're in the parliament.
I think that they'd probably be better suited to get back into the government and force their way into some, you know, power sharing, if they, you know, rather than, you know, bring Kabul to its knees the way they did, you know, before 2001. But I think whoever sits in that presidential seat is going to have to negotiate with them seriously. People say that Ashraf Ghani is probably in the better position, because he is Pashtun and he's got support from that whole part of the country, where, you know, Abdullah has a lot of has support from the north of Kabul. But, you know, I don't know. Anything is better than the negotiation that's been going on with Karzai in the United States, and it's just been foundering. And you know, but they are still active, and they're still dangerous, and they're, you know, there was a bombing, I think it was this morning.
Yeah, huge one.
Was it like 89 people? Probably. Mm-hmm. The count is higher now, but last I saw. So, and you have the whole question of Pakistan and what role, you know, the Pakistani Taliban will play.
Right. Well, now, David Petraeus promised Obama back in 2009 that you let me escalate the war, give me a few 30,000s is more troops over there, and we'll surge in there, and we'll whoop up on the Taliban so bad, we won't completely destroy them, but they'll be so bruised and battered and bloody by the spring, by July of 2011.
Yeah.
That then we'll bring them to the table and they'll do whatever we say. And so that never did happen, right? They just surged in and now they're surging down. Did they change anything on the ground other than they ran out the clock on Karzai's presidency, that kind of thing? Otherwise,
yeah.
Did they change the balance with that surge at all?
No. I mean, for years they'd been, you know, the military had been putting out these congressional reports that they were mandated to give Congress, you know, sort of a... you know, the state of, you know, affairs report. And, you know, you constantly heard these carefully, carefully framed phrases like, you know, we're turning back the momentum. You know, we have, you know, what
it's fragile what's and the reversible phrase? Gains. That's what you're looking
fragile,
for.
Fragile,
right?
Reversible,
yeah.
Gains. you know, the momentum is the one that always clings to my head. You know, and there was really not a lot of there was never any real confidence behind these statements, but they were carefully couched to indicate a level of progress that was just slow and steady, and that way Congress would be mollified and we'll go on with our business. I never, in all those years of the so-called counterinsurgency, the COIN campaign, ever heard anything more confident or more inspiring than these phrases, these sort of, you know, Orwellian phrases. And so I think when you talk to veterans, they will say, you know, they did their best, they cleared areas, but then they had to leave, and then the Taliban came back. And you see that story after story after story, you know, case after case, where they did their job, they had the firepower to pacify, you know, a certain area, certain outpost, a mountaintop, but then they had to leave eventually, and they just came back. And I think that's the story of Afghanistan, because I really haven't seen much evidence of there being, you know, places like Kandahar, where they did have a surge, and it was greatly publicized, you know, with McChrystal, and we're going to bring a government in a box, you know, to this area, and we're going to, you know, protect the population. And I remember, you know, people like David Kilcullen and others at the Center for New American Security saying, you know, the only measure of success is if how, you know, how well protected the Afghan people are, how we can keep them safe. That has never happened. You know, the number of civilian casualties has climbed up in that time. And for a period of time, our better, you know, our soldiers' injuries climbed up. So, you know, to answer your question, I don't think it changed much on the ground. I think at a certain point, we began just retracting and letting areas be reclaimed by the Taliban very quietly. And we've been in a withdrawal mode, you know, for over a year now. So there's
well,
about
the army that we're leaving in place is a complete joke, though, right?
Yeah. Well, they've never, you know, if you look at the reports about the training, you know, they'll say, well, you know, this so many units are able to conduct operations without, you know, a U.S. or be out in front, you know, with minimal support, and very few are. We've handed over cities and areas and districts to the Afghan military, but there never seemed to be a high level of confidence that they would be able to conduct operations without at least, you know, our firepower, or sadly, without losing a significant number of their own. And that's, you know, that's another sad story, is that when our casualties started going down, theirs started going up. And you'd say, well, that, you know, this is, they've taken back, they're taking control of their country, and that's what's supposed to happen. But, you know, at the same time, if we had created this safe space, you know, and we had changed things on the ground, we wouldn't be seeing these significant casualties that these Afghan soldiers have been incurring for a couple years now. But, you know, doesn't really make headline news. What makes headline news is when we don't even hear when our own soldiers die. I mean, much less at this point, you know, Afghan soldiers. So, no, I don't think there's been any change on the ground. I just think that there's been a sort of acknowledgement, a sad acknowledgement that, you know, this is, you know, a stalemate at best, and we're getting out. And, you know, the Taliban is still very active. And
well, even that, you know, I mean, how sure are you that we're getting out? Because they just put getting out off for another 2 years.
Yeah. Well, we have, what, 33,000 there now. And there's yet to be this bilateral security agreement signed. Karzai refuses to sign it, which would keep, you know, any number of combat troops there for another 2 years. From what I understand, both Abdullah or Ghani will sign this thing. So they'll sign it, and Obama wants, what, 10,000, close to 10,000 troops there for 2 more years. I personally, I mean, you know, from, you know, military experts that I talk to, do not believe that 10,000 troops are going to do squat other than protect our bases and embassy there. I don't see how that they're going to be making a difference in, you know, this balance of power between the Taliban and the Afghan military. I think they'll just be there to sort of train, and we've seen how well that's gone, and protect our interests over there. I honestly don't think that there's a lot of interest on the administration, at least this one, to protract this for much longer, because it's just been such a drain, Scott, that I think even the politicians in Washington are like, when are we going to get out of there? Wow. I mean, you have these war hawks who are ready to go back in any time to, you know, Iraq, you know, put more troops in Afghanistan. But I think that at this point, I think that they're in the minority, because it's been such a drain.
Well, you know, I mean, you mentioned
$1 billion for Afghanistan, you know, for aid and training alone, much less everything else that we've spent over there. It's just ridiculous.
Well, you know, when it comes to that kind of stuff, that's always been the case, and they've kept on anyway. And it seems like something has changed here for the worse, I think, from the anti-war point of view, which is what's happened in Iraq. And mm-hmm. the quite phony lesson, the presumption that everyone in media has, everyone in D.C. seems to have, that, you know, just shouldn't have left. Even if Dick Cheney yeah. shouldn't have done it, he just shouldn't have left. The lesson here is you just got to stay forever or else bad things will break out. And
yeah.
That is the new conventional wisdom in D.C. since the rise of the Islamic State in Western Iraq, Northwestern Iraq. So this one here is Josh Rogan today in the Daily Beast. Obama's counterterror plan has new doubters, his own generals and spies. And it's about how, you know, especially in terms of Afghanistan, they don't want to leave because what if
yeah.
comes back?
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, first of all, the Daily Beast has had like a whole parade of war hawks writing on this issue for the last month.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that they kind of skew, you know, reality in the sense that they seem to be really gunning to get back into Iraq. But, you know,
and Libya and everywhere else. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But I think what also skews is that you have these, if you have these active duty people who are talking off the record or as sources to people like Eli Lake or whatever, you know, that's their meat and potatoes. Of course they want to be in war. I mean, they want to be out. They want to be using their equipment. They want to be gunning. They want to be, you know, they want to be active. They want to be deployed. So I do think that they're in a minority because, you know, the veterans that I talk to, you know, I can't speak for all of them, and I haven't taken a, you know, an official poll. But, you know, I think once you get back here and you start absorbing, you know, what happened and how the policies had been fleshed out and how terribly they had gone, I think most veterans are saying, you know what, let's take care of our country first. You know, there's, you know, some of them talk about wanting to go back because it's unfinished business. And I understand that's a psychological thing that a lot of veterans go through. But I think when you look at policy, I don't hear a lot of them saying, yeah, we need to go back there and finish the job. So I'm not sure. And I think if you look at polling, most Americans don't want to go back to war, whether it be Afghanistan or Iraq. Most think that it was a waste. And most veterans, when polled, thought, you know, it was a waste to go to these wars. So I think this little contingent of war hawks who, you know, managed to get off the record comments from the military guys who, you know, frankly, they have to be self-sustaining somehow. I just don't think that that's reality at this point, but I could be wrong. I mean, we could get, you know, this presidential election just can start ramping up the Republican, you know, neocon, you know, interventionism. You know, you see that with Rick Perry going on, you know, the talk shows over the weekend, bashing Rand Paul and talking about going back into Iraq. Yeah, maybe you could get that whipped up again, but is that the real sentiment of America? I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, well, I agree with you. I mean, I think, and it's funny, too, how the anti-war movement is, in terms of, you know, the protest movement and all that, has completely evaporated now that the entire American population is finally behind them. You know, unfortunately, these groups are so small now with Democrats in power. But yeah, no, I'm with you that that the American people, I mean, clearly all the polls show that it's, you know, the new consensus, even if it's sad that it's new, it is the consensus that we've had it with all this kind of intervention. And after all, the safe haven myth for, oh, no, there could be an Egyptian somewhere in Afghanistan. And then, you know how Afghanistan is direct access to New York City and everything.
Yeah.
Even though
9/11
was waged by Egyptian graduate school students in Germany who had Western passports, and that was how they got their access. Afghanistan is actually exile on Earth. It's the furthest place to get to from anywhere. So you know, there's no real problem with a safe haven, only if you're trying to justify the policy. But I guess you're right that if they really have decided to change the policy, they can win that argument pretty easily.
Well, and what I think is the most important fight right now, and I would like to see the anti-war movement maintain a level of diligence on this, is fighting for the history of these wars, because if the neocons have anything, they do have direct access to the elite media. And so when they go on, you know, these talk shows and television shows and talk about how Petraeus won the war and Obama came in and lost it, this isn't just about here and now. This is about them trying to shape the way we look at this war for the next, you know, several decades to come. Mm-hmm. And this is what happened after Vietnam. You had a lot of, you know, military types who were going out there saying we could have won the war if we had the political will at home and the civilian, you know, masters hadn't screwed it up and the hippies hadn't protested. And, I mean, it sounds silly, but there is a big movement within the military, or there was, to shape the history of the war. And you still have people that talk like that and that are fighting over whether or not we won the war or could have won the war in Vietnam. So I think that we can be very diligent by, like, my story today that I wrote about Petraeus, because I see this is the real battle to come. I sadly don't think the American people or even our politicians really care about what happens in Iraq. I think they would let these poor people go down a hellhole, and they wouldn't give a crap about them. I think what the real battle here is going to be, you know, who sits on top of history. Is it Petraeus? You know, is it the people who stopped the war and finally got us out of there? You know, so I think people like yourself with your shows and you're talking and me writing and other people writing and talking about and reminding people what, you know, these policies brought. You know, with Petraeus, you know, with the betrayal of the sons of Iraq, with Petraeus overseeing directly or indirectly these Shia killing squads, you know, during the 2000s. I mean, all this is blowback. We're seeing the blowback. So to say that he won the war with his surge and Obama, the defeatist, came in and lost it is just wrong, and we shouldn't let that stand. We should counter it at every move.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And listen, in fact, I'd like to invite you on the other show for sometime later in the week to talk about just that, because we rightly, I think, spent the whole interview on Afghanistan, but that myth of the surge is problem of mine too. I sure would like to, and I mean the Iraq one. We cover the Afghan bogus surge, but the Iraq one, I hope we can arrange to talk in the coming days
absolutely.
About that, Kelly. Because it is a great piece too. That one is at UNS Review, Blowback in Iraq, the Petraeus legacy comes home, and then also the one that we were mostly talking about today. It's a couple of days out of date now, but it's still got a lot of great information in it. Afghanistan's deadly indecision. That's there at the American Conservative Magazine. Thank you so much for your time, Kelly. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. Kelly Vlahos from the American Conservative, UNS.com, and Antiwar.com. Thanks all of y'all for showing up tonight and listening into the show. I really appreciate it. I'm here every Tuesday from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern time here on Liberty Chat. Very happy to be a part of Liberty Chat. I really appreciate you guys showing up and listening very much. If you want to hear my other show, I'm live noon to 3 Eastern time weekdays at the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM. And I'm live on Sunday mornings from 8:30 to 9 Pacific on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. And so with that, I got a ton of work to do on a tight deadline tonight, and I got to go. But thank you all very much for listening, and I'll see you next week or tomorrow or on Twitter or what have you. Bye.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.